Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Well, after a very long week and an unprecedented 4 years, Joe Biden is on the verge of winning the presidential election based on leads in crucial battleground states, including Pennsylvania and Georgia. He is also ahead in Nevada and Arizona. The AP is reporting that Joe Biden's campaign says he will give a speech during prime time tonight. There's no word on what he plans to say or where he plans to speak. On today's show, we are going to Pennsylvania, Arizona, and Georgia. We begin in Georgia with Stephen Fowler, an award-winning reporter and photographer for Georgia Public Broadcasting. Hi, Stephen. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. We're also joined by David Dayan, executive editor of The American Prospect and author of the great book, Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. Hi, David. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you today. Well, Stephen, I want to start off with you. We're going to have you on for about 10 minutes. All eyes were on Georgia. Joe Biden was in the lead last night. I think it was about 1:30. I'm a little tired this morning on little sleep. But just give us the latest there. Georgia's Secretary of State says there will be a recount due to the razor-thin margin.
That's right. So 1:30 your time, 4:30 my time. Clayton County, which is a just south of Atlanta, the most Democratic county in Georgia, heavily African-American population, finished processing about 4,000 absentee by mail votes. Their margins were enough that it erased the deficit and put Joe Biden ahead by about 1,000 votes. There are still some votes remaining that need to be processed, also in counties that tend to lean Democratic, and the margin has expanded as some of those have been processed. But we still have thousands of votes to go. In addition to the absentee ballots that we know about, there are provisional ballots that must be cured. There are some military and overseas ballots that could come in, as well as some absentee ballots that were rejected for signature issues and other things, still having a little bit of time left to be cured. So the margin is tight, and it remains to be seen in the next few hours or maybe day or so what the final is going to look like.
What else stood out for you in the press conference that you attended?
So the press conference this morning, the Secretary of State, Republican Brad Raffensperger, mentioned this recount. Georgia's recount law is not automatic. The loser of a race, if they're within half a percentage point, is able to call for one. And by all indications, the Trump campaign, if they do indeed lose Georgia, has indicated that they will call for that. So there was a little bit of that procedure explained. That wouldn't happen until a couple weeks from now after the totals are certified, and 5 million ballots, they're all paper ballots this year for the first time, would have to be rescanned and retabulated. The other thing that stood out to me, Rose, is the messaging that you're hearing from a top Republican official. President Trump has spread misinformation and untruths about Georgia's vote counting process and in other states. And other elected officials in Georgia have kind of echoed that. But here, Brad Raffensperger, who is a Republican, has kind of held the line, saying that we will count every legal vote and our vote is safe and secure. And these elections officials are working to do things properly. And you should trust the outcome of the race, even if you don't like the result.
I also want to ask you before we let you go about the Senate races in Georgia. Right now, the Democrats do not have the Senate. And in order for Biden to get, you know, major legislation done, the Democrats need the Senate. There will be definitely one runoff and possibly two runoffs in Georgia. And people are already talking about this. Stephanie Ruhle on MSNBC this morning said that Wall Street wants to make sure that Democrats do not get the Senate back. And she said, expect an unprecedented amount of money being spent on one or two Senate races in Georgia. What are your thoughts about this, Stephen?
Right. So, you know, because of the margins of the presidential race being so close, Republican Senator David Perdue is under the 50% plus one vote threshold he would need to avoid a runoff. And the other Senate special election for the seat that's currently held by incumbent appointed Senator Kelly Loeffler has 20 candidates on the ballot. So no candidate got above 50% there. So this double barrel Senate runoff that's going to happen January 5th is going to continue to make Georgia the center of the political universe for the next 2 months. You know, it's over the holidays, so there's a lot of uncertainty about how voting is going to work, how campaigning is going to work, if people are going to issue a rebuke to Biden if he is the president-elect, or if they're going to be a rebuke to President Trump for whatever reason. And so there's a lot of things up in the air, but one thing is certain is that Georgia is the battleground state, as we see with these results. And with both Senate races, expect a lot of attention and money. And frankly, I just think I'm going to get nothing but campaign mailers for Christmas.
Right. It's going to be intense. David Dayan, you follow this very closely. What are your thoughts about what we can expect from these Senate runoffs in Georgia in January?
Yeah, I think it's a really going to be pretty fascinating. You have obviously Trump during the election was able to turn out a certain particular class of supporters who might not have any reason to want to continue to engage in politics if Trump is not around. At the same time, historically, these runoffs, particularly in Georgia, usually present a Republican result. Of course, this was at a time when Georgia was more of a red state. Obviously, it's very purple now. And you have, two candidates on the Democratic side, one being Reverend Raphael Warnock, the pastor at at Ebenezer Baptist Church, Martin Luther King's Church in Atlanta, who, you know, may be someone who's able to get out black voters, low propensity voters who don't normally turn out for January runoffs. So seeing all that come together, I think is going to be really fascinating. And it's, you know, while you would think that the Republicans start out as favorites just because they're, you know, the nature of runoffs in Georgia historically, I think there's reason to believe that Democrats have a fair shot.
Before we let you go, Stefan, there's been so many stories and a lot of people are talking about the incredible organizing that has been done in Georgia, you know, especially around Stacey Abrams and the great work that she's done to raise awareness about voter purges, voter suppression, and really fighting back against that. We're going to do a show about all of this next week, but can you give us just a sense of what you're hearing from organizers on the ground in Georgia?
Right. So, I mean, one of the reasons that Georgia was even remotely on the table for being in play this year is the work that's happened in previous elections. Stacey Abrams, about 5 or 6 years ago, had a plan for how to flip Georgia when she was the state House minority leader. She came within 55,000 votes of winning the governor's race in 2018 by organizing and mobilizing newer, younger, more diverse voters and going into parts of the state that didn't typically vote for a Democrat. And then after the election, they kept going. And so they built up this grassroots support. They built up the field work and they built up the infrastructure. And what you'll see when you look at Georgia's election results is if Biden does indeed win, it will come from absentee by mail votes from Democrats in rural Republican counties that in previous years might not have turned out.
Well, incredible. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us this morning, Stefan. Stefan Fowler is an award-winning reporter and photographer for Georgia Public Broadcasting. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And sticking with us for about 15 more minutes is David Dayan, executive editor of The American Prospect and author of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. What we just heard there, David, is it just shows that this organizing takes time. It really does. You can't just go into a community for one election cycle. You got to be on the ground and you have to build relationships.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And if you look at, you know, the three key states or three of the key states that are out right now that are very close and look to be going into Biden's column. You have Georgia, where you just talked about this years of organizing that has gone on. Arizona, where a similar dynamic has occurred, particularly around the backlash to Prop 209, the anti-immigrant law there, and also the reign of Joe Arpaio in Maricopa County. There's been a ton of Latino organizing that's gone on there. And similarly in Nevada, where the Culinary Workers Union, part of Unite Here, has done incredible work organizing low-wage Latino, largely Latino immigrant workers in that state, and has really turned it into a blue state. It's very telling that Unite Here was the only major union that did precinct walking during this election. And the three places that they did the bulk of their work was Nevada, Arizona, and Philadelphia. And these are the three states that are the closest that provided this margin of victory for Joe Biden. So I think it's very clear that, making those connections over years, doing that kind of on the ground work, which we also saw in Michigan and Minnesota with, Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib doing a lot of organizing. That's really critical for these kinds of races.
Right. And we're going to do a show about organizing next week. David, let's also take a deep breath and talk about what this really means, because we've all been so tied to our TVs and computers the last few days. People have not gotten much sleep. We've done shows about why Trump has gotten so many votes, and we'd love to have you on for another show about that. I mean, right now he's over 69 million. Biden is over 73 million. People are shocked that Trump got so many votes. But this is going to be a monumental shift from what we have seen over the last 4 years. I mean, we'll have those conversations about, Biden and who he's going to appoint, and is he going to ride this moderate wave, or is he actually going to go big? But can you talk about just how big of a shift this really is?
Well, certainly. I mean, anytime you have a transfer of power, it's from the Republican Party, especially the Republican Party as it stands right now, as a Trump party, and even a moderate Democrat, that's going to be a major change on all sorts of issues. Trump did not really pass very much legislation. The main piece of legislation he passed were a bunch of tax cuts. But he transformed the executive branch and transformed regulations and all sorts of ways, particularly on immigration policy, that the government operates. And Biden's going to have an opportunity to reverse all of that. None of it is forced by statute, and all of it can be changed. And that's going to be really interesting to see how far he goes with that and how much of a difference this new president will make.
Right. But the Democrats cannot change the judges that he's appointed. And that's where his mark is really going to last for decades to come.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, those are lifetime appointments. And, obviously the Supreme Court is majority conservative place, for years, if not for a generation. And there are literally hundreds or at least dozens of judges that were put on the circuit courts and in the district courts. And, that's one thing that has been talked about, the potential expansion, not just of the Supreme Court, but of the lower courts as well. But of course, if there's a Republican Senate, it's highly unlikely that you would see any kind of deal to expand the courts.
Right. And we need desperately a massive COVID bill. I mean, Biden has a big plan for additional PPE to use the Defense Authorization Act. He's got a big plan on contact tracing, given that we're seeing so many cases and we're about to head into a very sad winter. They're going to have to move really fast to pass some kind of bill. And then I just saw a tweet by someone in Harris County, Texas, saying, I know it's election day, but all of the cars in this photo are in line to go to eviction court. So you've got a lot of people who need help as soon as possible.
Yeah, and a lot of them need help before Joe Biden gets into office. You know, the two of the key unemployment programs that were put in during the CARES Act, the PUA, Pandemic Unemployment Assistance, that helps gig workers and independent contractors, as well as PEUC, which is extended benefits. It gives you another 13 weeks once you hit your 26-week limit. Both of those expire on December 31st. In addition, the so-called eviction moratorium, which is a bit of a leaky boat, as evidenced by your discussion about Harris County, Texas, but the moratorium that was put in place by the CDC also expires on December 31st. So we actually need the extension of these deadlines, or more help, or more relief before the end of the year, or else those things go to pass. And in the last couple days, Mitch McConnell has talked about reaching agreement on a stimulus package in the lame duck session. But that would likely be a very small package, very targeted. In fact, he's out today because we had a half-decent jobs report saying that this remarkable jobs report means that any relief needs to be very targeted. That's code for being small ball, basically, in Washington. And, it's unlikely that if McConnell is still in power in the Senate, that there would be a big stimulus package at the level that it might be needed.
David Dayan is executive editor of the American Prospect. If you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts right now as things have really turned around for Joe Biden? And according to all of the major media outlets, he is on the verge of winning. But we are waiting for more announcements coming out of Nevada. That should happen actually during the show, we think. And then Pennsylvania in the next couple hours. There will be a recount in Georgia. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. David, I'd love to hear your thoughts about what you think Trump is capable of in these next couple of months. According to reports, people within his inner circle were really afraid of just being honest with him about what we're seeing right now. So what do you think? What is he capable of in the next 2 months?
Well, I wrote a piece well before the election called The Winter of Our Discontent that kind of went over these 78 days between the election and the inauguration. And even in a best case scenario where Biden wins the election, I thought it was going to be a pretty harrowing time. I mean, if you think about it, we have COVID cases rising to the highest levels ever. And that's before any effect of 60 million people going to vote in the last couple of days. There's supposed to be a transition process where the Trump team briefs the Biden team that's incoming about what's happening, in various agencies and in the world. I don't expect any cooperation on that front. I don't know that even if McConnell and Pelosi come to some agreement on stimulus that, it seems like Trump is so disconnected that he might not even care and refuse to pass it or sign it into law. There's a lot of problems. And that's even before you get into what is he going to do with respect to pardons? What is he going to do with respect to possibly trying to pardon himself on the way out the door? There are all sorts of strange scenarios that could go on here. And what we know is that Trump kind of looks out for Trump. And so what we can expect is actions in the last waning days of his presidency that try to insulate or immunize himself in some way.
What role do you think he'll have in the future of the Republican Party? I just started reading this incredible piece by Jane Mayer in The New Yorker about all of the lawsuits that he's got to deal with. He's in a lot of debt. You know, some of the people that she quoted, and these are very serious scholars, say that he could be facing some jail time.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, one thing you could envision is that he is causing this ruckus about election fraud and all of these things and sort of undermining the confidence in elections as a ploy to try to get some sort of immunity, some sort of post-presidency immunity for himself. In a deal to you know, accept the results of the election. So that's one way that this could go. I'm not sure if that's going to happen or not, but, you know, I think that Trump is certainly a candidate and maybe even the favorite for the 2024 GOP nomination. This is someone who wants to probably has a revenge fantasy here that thinks that the presidency was stolen from him and might want to take it back. I think we have to seriously think about that. I've heard speculation about him buying a television network and creating a competitor to Fox News, and that will be the way he stays, you know, engaged. But there's no question, and if you look at the election results, this is true. Seeing the surge of support that he got, even from his 2016 numbers. That Trump and Trumpism is going to be the dominant force in the Republican Party well into the future.
Wow. So you really, because I've seen a few stories about this, Newsweek, a number of headlines, Trump could possibly run again in 2024, which is legal. You actually think he might do that?
Yeah, it's completely legal. I mean, the precedent is Grover Cleveland. In the 1880s, who won and then lost a very close election where he won the popular vote in the 1888 election over Benjamin Harrison, but lost in the Electoral College. And then he decided to run again in 1892 and he won. So the precedent is there in America. And obviously he'd be 82 years old if he ran again in 2024. But you know, he seems indestructible to me. So, I don't know that that would be much of a problem.
Incredible. So David, we're going to do shows about all of these issues. What else are you thinking about right now? I mean, wait, I don't want to get too ahead of ourselves because we still need an official announcement, right? But in terms of Biden, I mean, they have so much to do just in terms of cleaning up all of these disasters. Mm-hmm. I mean, even if you look at the rollbacks on environmental protections alone, you know, almost right. over 100, just yep. And that's just one piece of what this administration has done.
Yeah, absolutely. So real quick, we have written a series of pieces. We did it actually starting last fall, called the Day One Agenda, which is about all the things a Democratic president can do without having to pass any new legislation. And much of it is rollbacks of Trump policies like you were talking about. But there's also really powerful options that a president can take under their own authority that haven't been tested really, that are, you know, through legislation that Congress has passed and delegated to the executive branch. Things like canceling student debt or lowering prescription drug prices or all kinds of crackdowns on Wall Street and monopolies and things like that. So I urge you to check that out at prospect.org/day-one-agenda. And we're going to have much more on that front. Obviously, personnel being policy, we're also going to look at who Biden's cabinet selections might be and what that would mean for having an aggressive agenda. So, you know, those kinds of things I think are going to be very important. And then so much of the Biden presidency, or at least how it's going to be envisioned, relies on those two Senate races in Georgia in January.
Exactly. Well, David, we would love to have you on to talk about that story you wrote because that angle is so important. I know you have to get to a meeting, so thank you so much for joining us.
All right. Thank you.
Take care. David Dayan is executive editor of The American Prospect and author of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. Actually, I just got an email from Sue, who wanted to let us know that Manny's is organizing the first joint conversation with two Senate candidates from Georgia. Manny's is a really nice space in San Francisco that a lot of people gather in to talk about politics. It also has a cafe. But this is for anyone if you're interested in this. It'll be this Monday, a conversation with John Ossoff and the Reverend Raphael Warnock. They will be vying for Senate races in January. This is probably going to be one of the most expensive runoffs in history. It's this Monday at 4:30 Pacific time, and we will put the link on our website if you'd like to take part in this conversation. We're going to take a quick break. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. While we wait to get our next guest on the line, I just want to give out the phone number if you would like to just share your thoughts about this week and how stressful it's been and where we are right now. We're going to do a lot of shows in the coming weeks about the next 2 months under Trump and then Biden's transition team. So you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. While we try to connect with our next guest, I will read you some updates from the New York Times and The Guardian. The Guardian reports that the Clark County Registrar of Voters in Nevada says the county will provide another ballot update this afternoon. Clark County posted the results of about 30,000 ballots this morning, and Biden's lead in the state has grown to 20,137 votes. So remember we talked yesterday, some news outlets have already given Biden Arizona's electoral votes. Now, that is not across the board because it hasn't officially been announced by the AP. But if that does happen, and right now Biden is up by, 50,000 or so votes in Arizona, but they're 93% in, he would just need six more electoral votes, which Nevada is six. So that would give him the 170 he needs. But this morning, I got an alert on my phone saying that he flipped Pennsylvania. And right now, 96% of the votes are in. Biden is at 3.3 million. Trump is at 3.2 million. 20 electoral votes in Pennsylvania. So we are just waiting on these. We just have to wait for the votes to be counted. And again, big hats off to the vote counters because they're working as fast as they can. In some cases, they worked overnight, and we want them to do their job and get the rest that they need. And so if it means that we don't get the results until tonight, then so be it. Although I know that we would like to have the official results right now. The Guardian also reports that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris will address the nation in a primetime speech this evening. Biden is on the verge of victory after taking the lead in Pennsylvania. And let's go to Philadelphia, where we have Mike Elk on the line. Mike is a labor reporter and founder of Payday Report. Hi, Mike. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Rose, I'm actually in Pittsburgh. There are other cities in Pennsylvania.
I'm on 4 hours of sleep. Sorry about that, Mike.
No. I'm just joking with you. I love your show. I'm just joking.
No, it's fine. I actually have that in the run sheet, but I'm looking at all these different... Anyway, you're in Pittsburgh. Great to have you, Mike. So
yeah.
A lot of people woke up early this morning and found that Joe Biden flipped the state of Pennsylvania. Give us a sense about the organizing. What's going on, or what has been going on with the organizing in Pennsylvania?
Well, I think it's really shown the success of the Black Lives Matter movement in many ways. If you look at what occurred, the rural areas of Western Pennsylvania went even more red in this election. However, The turnout in the cities, both in Pittsburgh and in Philadelphia, as well as in Erie. Erie last time went for Trump. This time it went back to the Democratic fold. If you look at the turnout in those cities, particularly among African-American base, it was very, very strong. It was some of the strongest it's been in years. And that's what's really propelling this election in a large way, which is important to note, because earlier today, Connor Lamb, he's a congressman from Western PA. He's won a bunch of races. He's this young wonder kid who, is basically a Republican, but, has a Democrat in front of his name. He votes with them all the time. Lamb was coming out saying today, blaming people that were calling for defund police. This was in the Washington Post, for hurting election chances of people. But I actually think that the Black Lives Matter strategy showed that, you know, concentrating on those messages of racial justice in the urban core and firing up that base that wasn't fired up last time for Hillary made the difference this time. And I think we're seeing that across the nation.
Okay, so this is fascinating, Mike, because the Washington Post, I'm sure you've seen this or read it, they had a piece about a call among between Nancy Pelosi and House members who won their races and lost their races. And there was a lot of tension between the moderate wing, especially those who lost their races, and the progressive wing.
Well, yes. I mean, and I think there's always that tension. But I think what's showing is that the moderate message isn't appealing. People want change agents at this time. If you look at Detroit, if you look at Minnesota, if you look at Atlanta, any of these places, the turnout numbers, the votes came from heavily African-American areas. And that's what propelled this election. And so, you know, this message about being moderate, I don't know where it really gets them. I mean, you have a country where, you know, people are fine voting with a racist like that. And so unless you show up and you make people believe that are easy to be your supporters to vote, I don't see what the point is of focusing on so much of these moderates, many of whom can't win. But let's look at California. You look at Katie Porter, right, down in Southern California. She flipped the district from Republican to Democrat. She's one of the most progressive members of the House. She was easily elected in Orange County, running on a populist message. Orange County is not an easy place for any Democrat. And so I think that really shows the limits of that sort of moderate message.
Right. And Katie Porter is one of the strongest members of Congress who really go after CEOs. I mean, we've really never seen anything like this.
Exactly. And so, you know, you have plenty of examples of people running populist campaigns and winning. There's no real evidence to show how much that hurts. To the contrary, I think, you know, what Summer Lee, you know, the first black woman elected to the state house out here, has argued is that it shows that, you know, the votes turned out because folks, particularly associated with Black Lives Matter, organized.
Mm. And Mike, let's stay on this for a minute, because it's so important to talk about why Trump got so many votes. But it's also important to talk about the incredible organizing that went on. You actually wrote a piece, and in one of your pieces, you quoted Madeline Fortos, a 16-year-old who is obviously not old enough to vote, but she's so active in this election.
A Mexican-American 16-year-old, she was living deep in Trump country, you know, traveled almost an hour to get to this protest. And you're seeing a younger generation that's fired up. And I think what's interesting, you know, I covered the 08 election. I covered the early years of the Obama administration, is that, you know, we're not kidding ourselves on the left about who Joe Biden is. I think we know already that we're going to have to push and we're going to have to fight Joe Biden on a lot of things. But I think it gets back to something that Andrew Dinklicker, you know, the Secretary Treasurer of the Union, said the other day, which is that, you know, which boss do we want to fight? Do we want to fight a boss like Trump that's going to call the cops on us, beat the crap out of us, pull all kind of stuff? Or do we want to fight somebody like a weak boss like Biden, who does have to, can be applied, you know, street heat, can be applied political pressure on? You know, sure, Biden's in the pocket of big corporate interests, but he's a lot better of a person to fight against than to fight against Biden. And I think a lot of the folks I'm talking with, particularly folks in Black Lives Matter, who know that they won this election, know that they're going to have a fight on their hands. And I think you're seeing Ocasio-Cortez, and I think we're in a much stronger position, the left, than we were at the beginning of the Obama first term, because we have more leadership in Congress. You know, the squad, Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, Katie Porter, Bernie Sanders. You know, we have progressives that are going to be able to take on Biden and really organize. And we learned, I hope we learned that lesson of the first year of Obama, which is that you have to organize, you have to get them to define the agenda early on. Because no matter what happens, Congress is going to be very narrowly locked, and it's going to be tough to get anything done. And in some instances like that, it's best to go big or go nothing at all.
Right.
Because you're going to have to compromise.
And this is really your area of expertise, Mike. It's going to be so fascinating to find out who the Biden administration appoints to these important positions, like labor secretary, for example. You know, are they going to actually back workers and support unions? Because last night on MSNBC, Ed Rendell said that Democrats have not been able to bring workers back into the Democratic Party in Pennsylvania. He said they went for Trump in 2016, and they went for Trump again this time.
Well, look at Ohio. Majority of union households voted for Trump. they voted more for Trump in 2020 than they did in 2016. That is an indictment of the strategy of organized labor, of going along with it. You know, and really, I think also just an indictment of the fact that outside of Nevada and Arizona, you know, there was no real strategy to go door-to-door except Unite Here. And that played a big role in swinging Latino voters in those states. We didn't see labor engaging in the way it traditionally engages on the doors, and that definitely played a role. But also not having a message that resonates played a role. And, you know, there's, I think, this big, some big questions for the AFL-CIO. You know, Richard Trumka, the president of the AFL-CIO, has been talking about retiring for some time now, and this might push him even further on that realm, because this is a massive embarrassment to see unions doing worse among union voters than they did in the last election.
Right.
And I want to circle back to something. You know, I saw Bernie Sanders in Pittsburgh about a week and a half ago speak, and, you know, there's been some talk that Bernie might be Secretary of Labor. Mm-hmm. And the one thing that Bernie said clearly is that he went to Biden, and Biden promised him that they would walk picket lines. Now, remember, in 07, Obama made the same promise to walk picket lines. And then when Wisconsin happened, when they stripped workers of collective bargaining rights in 2011, he never showed up. He never showed up to any picket lines throughout his presidency. So the fact that Bernie, the needle has moved so much even on that issue. I remember when I was working at Politico, I was working with Maggie Haberman, who's now at the New York Times. And I said to Maggie in an email, we were writing a story on labor's feelings about the primary field together. And I said, you know, this election, this was like December 2014, you know, they're really going to demand that people walk picket lines. And she said to me, you don't really think they're going to do that. So I think that goes to show how much Bernie's already changed the conversation. I think you're going to have to see a much more active labor movement because there's a problem there. There's a serious problem there, and labor hasn't figured out how to fix it yet.
And people remember this, right, Mike? They remember that you made a promise and you didn't keep it.
Exactly.
Mike, before we let you go, I just want to ask you, since you are in Pittsburgh, how are people coping with COVID and not having jobs and small businesses closing with no relief in sight?
Well, I think it's, you know, it's tough for a lot of people. It's really tough here. Pittsburgh, you know, it's been better than most places, but, you know, there's a lack of economic development. And so I think it's going to be interesting. You know, McConnell says he's not going to push a big COVID relief bill through. It'll be interesting to see what Biden does. And it'll be interesting to see what he will do with pressure from people like AOC and Bernie Sanders. You know, I thought the most interesting moment of the debates was Biden's Freudian slip in the debate where he said the Green New Deal will pay for itself. You know, he you know, obviously was arguing that he was opposed to the Green New Deal, but then he just said it would pay for itself. And I think you're going to see him expand on what they did in the stimulus last time. I mean, you know, Biden was in charge of that. I think you're going to see an expansion of Medicare and Medicaid to cover people affected by COVID. I think there's going to be a big fight over building a contract tracer army, of building, you know, some sort of climate change core, you know, to address some of these Green New Deal type visions. We're going to see, I think, a big fight over that. And I think right now, the challenge between now and, I think, you know, Biden taking office for the left is going to be how much pressure we apply to get certain demands made. Because if Congress is going to be that narrowly deadlocked, that means that we're going to have to fight for 2022. And that means we're going to have to put up a big vision and we have to make the battle lines clear. I think, you know, this was a victory against fascism, but it wasn't necessarily a victory for progress.
Mike, as always, thank you so much for your analysis. We'd love to have you back in the coming weeks.
Thank you so much, Rose.
Thank you. Mike Elk is a labor reporter and co-founder of Payday Report, a crowdfunded labor publication based in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where Joe Biden leads now Donald Trump by just under 12,500 votes. And I'm looking at NBC. They're saying that Pennsylvania is not going to be officially called probably until this afternoon. But Joe Biden is on the verge of winning because he is in front in several key battleground states. Now I would like to welcome Rob Odell to the show. Rob is a Pulitzer Prize winning investigative and data reporter at the Arizona Republic. Hi, Rob. Thanks so much for joining us again. Hi, do we have Rob?
Thank you for having me.
Hi, great to hear from you, Rob. Thanks for joining us. So you just wrote a piece this morning. Can you hear me, Rob?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay. You just wrote a piece this morning with a couple colleagues. Trump draws closer to Biden in Arizona, but falls off the pace needed to win the state. Give us the latest from Arizona, Rob. What are the numbers?
Well, interestingly enough, we just had another story this morning, and basically it showed there were about 75,000 ballots for Maricopa County, and basically it shows, well, Trump won those ballots. He fell far off the pace he needs to win the state. So so basically he needs about 57% of all the remaining votes from every batch, from every county. And in this latest one from Maricopa, he only got about 50%. So it's looking a lot stronger for Biden this morning than it was even yesterday or the day before. Because and one of the things that's interesting about this election is it's kind of flipped the normal way ballots come in on its head. Normally, Republicans vote early and Democrats vote the day of. And this has sort of flipped everything. And we had not gotten a look at the early ballots that were dropped off at the polls. Typically, those are Democratic. But there was some thinking that maybe because Republicans voted so heavily at the polls this year that they would be more Republican. But this latest batch of ballots didn't show that. So Trump has fallen off the pace he needs to take the state. And there's going to be another group of votes dropped at 7 p.m. And that may be decisive for sort of the final word on the state.
Republicans have dominated Arizona since 1952, according to the AP. What explains this flip? Can you tell us about the organizing that you've seen over the past year and just what you're hearing from voters?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think the biggest thing that's changed is the demographics of the state has changed. We have probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 500,000 new voters in 2020 versus 2016. And we've just had a massive influx of people coming to Arizona from all over the West, from California. And we just have changing demographics, and that growth has just made, especially Maricopa County, more purple. It's not liberal, but it's way less conservative than it was. It used to be that that Democrats who tried to win statewide tried to lose as narrowly as they could in Maricopa County and then win in Pima County, where Tucson is, which is sort of the state's liberal bastion. And during the last two election cycles in 2018 and 2020, Democrats have won Maricopa in statewide elections. And that's sort of flipped the whole idea of how the state looks in terms of voting patterns on its head.
Hmm. So you have changing demographic. You also, I've been reading a couple stories about the youth vote in Arizona. Young people, especially young Latinos, came out in big numbers.
Yeah, and it's really the culmination of about, 10 to 15 years of hard work in Arizona. Mm-hmm. Like, we've written the story, Latinos are going to come out for this election, four or five, six election cycles. But it was really this year that sort of all that long-term work coincided with the passion of young people and Latinos for what's going on in the country to kind of coalesce together and finally bring out that Latino vote in a way that moves the needle that to be honest, has not happened in Arizona before this year.
Your colleague, Shondine Silversmith, wrote a piece called Navajo and Hopi Voters Turn Out in Force on Election Day. Unfortunately, Rob, the Native vote just does not get much attention around the election. So I was really glad to see that she wrote this piece. Can you just give us any insights there? The Navajo Nation really came out in force also.
Yeah. And particularly the Navajo Nation and the Native American vote is particularly powerful, especially in particular congressional districts, because they go so heavily Democratic. So especially in CD1, which covers a lot of the rural part of the state, but also the Indian reservations, mm-hmm. You have a powerful pull by Native American voters there.
And we'll definitely do a show about the native vote in the coming weeks. Let's talk quickly about the important Senate races. It was just called about an hour ago officially that Mark Kelly has won his race against Republican incumbent Senator Martha McSally.
Yeah, and we've sort of known that this was going to happen for a while because McSally was trailing even the president. So she's even behind, you know, the president is somewhat close to Biden. She was even behind that. So we've sort of known this for a while. Some other organizations had called it, and it was just recently called this morning. But yeah, I mean, we basically have two now Democratic senators. We hadn't had a Democratic senator win in the state since 1988. And they both ran really well-funded and really centrist campaigns, really almost Republican-like campaigns. And they were able to sort of to cross over a little bit of Republican voters who were unhappy with Martha McSally, both in 2018 and 2020. McSally was the loser in both of those Senate races. So, I mean, we've kind of seen this sort of sea change in Arizona that if you're a Democrat and you run a good campaign and you are relatively centrist, you have a chance to win. When, you know, even 4 years ago, that was just not true at all.
Rob O'Dell is a Pulitzer Prize winning investigative and data reporter at the Arizona Republic. Rob, I want to take a couple calls because some people have been waiting patiently. Let's hear from Benjamin in San Francisco. Hi, Benjamin. Thank you for holding. Do we have Benjamin? We do not. Do we have another caller, Eileen in Mountain View?
Oh, hi. Yes.
Hi.
This is not exactly relevant. And I wondered what you thought the chances are of the Republican governors appointing their own electors if Biden wins. Thank you.
Well,
I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Eileen. The threat was there, Rob. Not sure you could hear Eileen, but she said, what do you think of Republican governors assigning their own electors? I was glued to the TV last night. So many lawyers said it's just not going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think there were definitely plans to talk about how to do it. There was a lot of good journalism about how it was a possibility in Pennsylvania. I just think the way that the votes have come out, I think that Republican legislators have come to the conclusion that that really wouldn't go well. And I kind of don't see it. I'm not saying it could never happen, but I've just kind of seen, I think you even had the head of the Pennsylvania Senate said basically whoever wins the popular vote, is going to take the electors. And so I don't know that the public has a taste for this. Maybe if there was massive fraud or if the race was, so close that it was like one or two votes. But I just think the way it's played out, I just think the public doesn't have it.
Right. Yeah. A number of lawyers last night said none of this.
For that. Republican legislators kind of seen that.
Right. Sorry about that. We're having a little problem with Rob's line. Rob, I also wanted to ask you, hearing you talk about what goes on in Arizona, so many of us remember the time of Sheriff Arpaio, the Show Us Your Papers. I mean, really extreme anti-immigrant politicians in Arizona, really awful laws that were passed there. How do you think these big wins in Arizona will change that? How do you think the changing demographic will change all of that?
I kind of think, and can you hear me okay?
Yes, you're fine now.
Oh, okay. I kind of think that it already has been changed. I mean, we have a really great podcast that looked at SB 1070 in the 10 years since SB 1070. I think that anti-immigrant rhetoric, that Arpaio rhetoric, along with the changing demographics, has already been changed. Arpaio was voted out in 2016. He tried to get back in the race this year, lost in the primary. His deputy throughout the whole thing ran against the current sheriff and was basically demolished. And the sheriff who beat Arpaio in 2016 was the first Maricopa public official to get over 1 million votes. So I think there was a group of people after 20 after 2010 and after SB 1070 who said we don't want this. And then with the change in demographics, I think it already has changed a lot. I mean, I'd just like to point out that it's Maricopa County that's becoming more purple. The rural areas of the state are still incredibly red. But Maricopa County is such a big part of the population in Arizona that it's sort of changed the whole state.
And quickly, before we let you go, how is COVID affecting people there, given that, you know, there's no relief in sight? A lot of people are still without jobs. Small businesses are closing.
Yeah, it's ramping back up here. We were particularly bad in the summer, in part because we took off restrictions very quickly. Mm. And also because for us in the summer, we're all inside because it's so hot. We have a little bit more relief now because now it's cooling down and we can be more outside. That's sort of like the reverse of how it is on the East Coast. But yeah, it's bad here too. I mean, we just got a notice from my daughter's school that they might go back to all virtual learning after the kids went, you know, after only being back for 3 weeks.
Hmm. Wow. Well, Rob, as always, thank you so much for your great reporting, and we'd love to have you on in the near future.
Thank you.
Rob Odell is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative and data reporter at the Arizona Republic. And I'm just looking at the latest breaking news. Nothing new to report here. The New York Times reports that Joe Biden has increased his lead in Nevada to 1.6 percentage points, which means that Trump's path to victory in Nevada appears to be more difficult. Well, it has been a very long week, and it looks like Joe Biden will be the president-elect when we are with you on Monday. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance and Damian Miner for keeping our studio running. And let us know what shows you'd like us to do in the coming weeks, because it's going to be so important to find out what the Trump transition team does over the next 2 weeks. So we'd love to hear from you. Your call at kalw.org. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.